So acknowledged by research team. All complicated good work is undertaken in the team. I led this team, but it had strong contributions from all the people up here, and I'd like to acknowledge the funders who made this work possible in the first instance. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about work that was undertaken in Canada. Before I do that, give a little bit of background. I'm sure, that early intervention is incredibly important in preventing reading difficulties. The old adage, "Postition time," proves to be true when we think about reading intervention. We know that we can intervene early on and prevent reading difficulties for a very large number of students and support the ongoing reading needs of those even if they do continue to. So many children struggle with literacy. Perhaps as many as 2/3 of those children can be pushed into the average range with early energetic and evidence-based interventions. And even if that isn't successful, it provides a very principled way for thinking about the difficulties that young people have. It allows us to rule out the difficulties solely as being a kind of environmental deficit. They're not struggling with readers because they've not had the right teaching, if they've had the right teaching. Right? Okay, so we have learnt a lot over the past 25 years or more about what works. And while we're built upon that body of knowledge, good science is cumulative. We know that the system of teaching phonics is a successful strategy for supporting literacy in the general sense. And we know that assembling pronunciations is quite possible within an alphabetic system. So the teaching letters and correspondences and phonological awareness skills is likely to be important. We need to expose children to authentic texts. We need to teach children relevant vocabulary. And we need to make sure that all that is wrapped within practices for assisting comprehension. All of that requires us to differentiate heavily to the needs of individual learners for that to be maximally successful. So I'm going to take that kind of platform as read, as a foundation of this.
Just to let you know, the previous speaker questioned the first point.
We'll come back to that one. Okay. I will say, I make my claims based upon a review of the systematic review of the literature. So we can come back to that. It's going to be an interesting topic table. Okay, so that being said, sustained interventions are likely to be effective, and we therefore apply to do research where we follow a group of young people, intervening where appropriate, in addition to the work that we gave to support teachers in evidence-based practice. So we have four waves of intervention. I'm going to tell you about three of those. The last one, I will say, the data I presented today was work that we did elsewhere. We didn't follow this cohort all the way through to the third grade. Grade one, about the same as year one, and so on, in the North American context. Okay, so what's new? Given what I just said, where else might we go? One thing that we might do is to think about the way that we teach grapheme phoneme correspondences in a maximally effective fashion, okay? And how we might use that in a theoretically driven way. So, one of the things that children do, probably, when they learn their grapheme phoneme correspondences, is that they don't just sort of put those away, but they automate those grapheme phoneme links so they're fast and efficient and connected. They create pathways for children to recognise words in alphabetic systems. So opportunities to automate, make fluent those grapheme phoneme correspondences are likely to be important. So opportunities to do this within texts is likely to be effective. So if we consider words like was, which if we did apply a grapheme phoneme correspondence rule to, we might say w-a-s-p and then say wasp. Provides a problem. So we've got to be thinking about that. But we've got lots of words that children will meet that follow the standard letter sound correspondence rules. Words like belt, for example, but 10. never seen the world before. Okay, so how do we help children deal with the complexities of the English spelling system? English is what is sometimes referred to as an opaque system or a deep orthography. That means it's a pain in the neck. It means, you know this, right? This is your day-to-day pain, right? There are lots of exceptions to so-called rules. I have led people down all sorts of different paths in helping them attempt to make sense of what to do. I'm going to argue that the underlying alphabetic structure is important, and that what children need are strategies on top of regular phonics, on top of, not instead of, to help deal with this stuff. And that idea is not particularly new in and of itself. So, for example, English has complexity at the level of variable vowels. The vowels are the problem. There are many vowel diagraphs. You spent long hours, I'm sure, working with those with different people. So, some people say, well, what we need to teach is a set for variability. And what that means is a mental strategy. A mental strategy for being flexible in dealing with that variability. Okay? So this is the idea that we may need to apply more than one phonic rule for the same letter sound correspondence. And we might need to help children to flip or manipulate those until they get to the right one for the particular word they're working with. Okay? The variable vowel. You could also say, though, that the ability to decode, to sound out, requires that assembly of sounds, even for words that follow the rules. You have to assemble those sounds, the d, of go to dog. However, maybe there's an unacknowledged stage there, which some children may have difficulty with. Is matching what you might call that spelling string, that spelling pronunciation, against a known word. Because a dog is a dog, but a d or g isn't automatically a dog for children, right? Okay. One is a phoneme string, one is a word. And I've known many adult dyslexics tell me that this is a difficult issue for them. So, the first part has been emphasised historically in phonics programs. What about an emphasis on the second part? What happens if we put that in? An ability to be flexible in these ways, what you might call mental flexibility in using phonics, predicts the growth in children's reading of regular words that follow rules and those exception words. We know that to be the case. We know that it's associated with vocabulary knowledge because the meanings of words end up being rather important in this process. So what happens if we teach both of them? Does it improve reading over what you might call standard phonics approaches? That was our question. So we ran a console quality dual site two-arm cluster randomized control trial. That's clear, isn't it? Basically, you know, when you learned in science, a fair test. We compared two groups, one we gave the intervention, the new intervention, the new improved soap powder, and one which was business as usual, regular phonics of high quality. We made sure that they were comparable at the beginning of the trial, and then we compared the performance at the end of the trial to see if our new intervention added any value. That's what that means in favour of the. So we ran this in Quebec, in Canada, and we also ran a separate trial in Alberta in the far west, so we had east and west. We had 50 classrooms, 26 teachers involved, 429 students were initially screened. It was a very big study. And from that, we identified children we called at risk after the fall semester. So basically, this is kind of Christmas of year one. We're identifying the lowest performing 30%. Having also established that the classroom teacher, generally speaking, is pretty good. Okay, so these are kids who are a bit wobbly, they'll benefit from a bit of extra support. So we screened all those, we put them into these groups. We intervened in small groups, because I think that's an effective way of working with young people who are at risk, a range of personalities and abilities in there. And we had our novel response to intervention phonics program. We need to have a better name for this. It's called Direct Mapping and Set Variability. Doesn't really roll off the tongue. Should we call it mental flexibility using phonics or something like that? Okay. And then we had a standardised common or best practices that involved those best practices that I talked about at the beginning, and which people generally agree with, apart from the other speaker maybe, about being reasonably good standing starting points. Okay, so we ran into a term, we ran into small groups. We made sure that the overall teaching was sort of equal quality. We checked how it was done. I trained graduate students who were experienced teachers. Some of them were resource room teachers, which is kind of a Senko sort of a role in the North American context. And we evaluated what we were doing. So, in our direct mapping set for variability, we had systematic synthetic phonics. We taught phonic rules. We taught children to flip grapheme phoneme correspondences until the word fitted. So we would teach more than one pronunciation for an individual phoneme. And you can do that even at the beginning, right? So you can things like soft and hard C and G sounds, for example, and vowels, all sorts of things you can do. Voiced and unvoiced S sounds. So you've got that. We train children to use these alternative models when decoding didn't work. So we encouraged them to decode, but gave them a plan B for when it's a great step on top of phonics, not instead of. So what happens when you have words like wasp and shoulder, and they regularise them, they say shadow and mask, and then they don't make the connection. We had shared book reading, and we made sure that the books exemplified the letter sound correspondences that we taught on that day. We think that's a helpful component. That the grapheme phonemes you work with on that day, connect them up to text where they're richly exemplified so that children get it. They're no longer abstract. All this was done in a fun way. We had fun and games, we had movement, we had laughter, we had a sense, we had students who wanted to be involved in this and who weren't, and too good at reading to be involved. So we tried to make that sense of fun in this, and it was heavily differentiated. Here's an example of this idea of strategy. So I've presented this as a five-step. Depending on children's ability to focus on this sort of structure, we would simplify this, obviously, for children. But here's the core. They're taught to blend. They evaluate this attempt to synthesize a conversation. Is this a word or no? Does this make sense? Okay, that's a step we get to think about. Sometimes we might even give it a sentence context to put it in, to play around. We would obviously read that too. Children who evaluate this, okay, then if it isn't, what do you do about it? What's our plan? Okay, let's flip the vowel or replace the consonant in some way. Then they resynthesize, have another go. Now, does it work? Does it make sense? Okay. Hopefully, more often it does, as they do that in the second material. So they've got metacognitive strategy for making sense of words that they mean. Here's examples you'll recognise the text, of course. Here are examples where we have a high density of the grapheme phoneme. The grapheme phoneme, in this case, it was the owl and mouse, and we have this pattern in their mouse and house, and we got children to play with that in text. And they read those words where they could in the shared book reading. So we would read with them, we didn't necessarily expect them to know text, but they would be required to have a good look at the words that we focused on with those graphic phonemes. So genuinely shared. Intervention 2 had all those things we talked about before. I'll summarise that just super quick. It's the stuff we've said. Yes, it had phonics. We taught the phonic rules. We didn't teach them strategy, of course, because it's the control. We did do the shared book reading, and we taught them a lot of high-frequency sight words. Okay. Same differentiation, same sense of fun, well delivered by very, very competent and experienced staff in both cases. What did we get? So here's our results. So we've got right at the beginning of the year, pre-grade 1, September. We've got mid-grade 1, which is actually when our intervention started. You'll remember that it was after Christmas. So what you can see from the blue to the red, that's clear, under the lights. You've got movement there. They started with a standard score of 75, which is very low. They've moved up, in both cases, up towards 80 as a standard score. So that's some evidence that the teachers are adding value. So the teachers were okay. Certainly at least okay, not more. The key but contrast across the two Manhattans is this orange-ish colour. And you can see that on a word, this word reading measure, the struggling readers are pushing up towards well towards average as a group at this point. And those who have got the common best practices were doing okay, but that graph isn't that R isn't as tall, and that's a significant difference. It was also there at the start of grade two. So we came back to the schools and said, do you remember us? We came back, we tested the kids after the summer break, after they tended to fizzle out, and we could still pick up the effects of our intervention. We hadn't done anything since about April, May in intervention terms. We came back in September, October, and we can pick it up. So we feel that there's a sustained impact of our interventions on the part of this group as a whole. Very happy with that. Similar sorts of patterns played out. This is pseudo words, made up words, nonsense words, pure test of decoding. Similar sorts of patterns there are, just summarised, that's the case. Not quite as stark, but fair. And you wouldn't necessarily expect the effect to be as strong, because this is all about making sense, isn't it? It's about meanings and making sense. They benefited from the phonic size, but they didn't necessarily benefit from this idea of the mental flexibility and connecting it up with vocabulary and meanings. It wouldn't work for a student. We gave a sentence comprehension measure. Graph has a different shape because we couldn't inflict a sentence comprehension measure on children who were struggling at the beginning of year one, of course. So because these are measures at the end, but we do know that these children are reasonably welcome. Balance at the beginning to make this fair as a comparison. So what you can see there is you've got the DMSFVR pieces in blue, and common and best practices is really starting to show up at that start of grade two. So we didn't get an effect at the end of our immediate end of our intervention, but it's there 3 or 4, 5, 6 months later, perhaps where it's percolated through and facilitated and allowed children to become better comprehenders. Kind of a sleeper effect. So, okay, we think that this is successful in summary. We don't think that repeating common or best practices in small groups, if the teacher's doing a good job already, just repeating the same old thing doesn't necessarily give an awful lot of value in our analysis. We need to be a little bit careful about that, I trust, but just putting it there. We've got medium effect sizes for this, and I'll just give you a sense that I'm not going to report this data here, but one of my graduate students did an excellent job of looking at this in Quebec, where students were exposed to English and French at the same time. So if we intervene only in English, what happens to French? What she found is she could find similar patterns in French to those I've reported in English. It kind of seems to transfer. These smart little kids are able to actually make the link across languages. So again, it suggests something very general that they're learning, which is what you'd expect from a strategy. Second study. Okay, this also had a phonics focus. So we're picking up the same kids again. Well, not quite, because we wanted to pick up from that larger group all those children who are still struggling. And these children are now in year two. So we know that phonics is based upon the application of letter sound correspondences and phonemic awareness, and that both of these need to be supported. That's a kind of foundation sort of. Does that do the job? If you do some work of contrasts across countries, like Phil Seymour did a few years ago, he was able to say that if you look at the performance of children across European countries, Scottish children, and he didn't have anything against Scotland, but he was Scottish, he was children learning to read in the deep spelling system of English, struggle clearly, in comparison with students in other languages, where the spelling system is very transparent, very simple. So by the end of primary one, so the perception of primary 2 years, the European and Scandinavian countries, on matched words, had about 90% accuracy. Denmark, 92. The Scottish kids have 34% by the end of primary one, and they're still only at 76% by the end of primary two. They have 3 years of focus. It's still not there. That's what happens if you try and learn a deep spelling system. It needs more work. So I'll make the point that it's not all done by the end of year one. This is an ongoing and cumulative piece of work to master a complicated spelling system. So it's okay to intervene in grade year two. Okay, so you might recognise this. This is a list of the grapheme phoneme correspondences that you would teach if you were following Joel Phonics. Okay. So imagine you've been a thorough teacher of your Joel Phonics in year one. All of your students have done a great job too. They've learnt all of these grapheme phoneme correspondences and they're applying them. Okay, job done, right? Wonderful, go. Well, not if you want to read actual books. This man is Robert Munch. If you're Canadian and you're 5 or 6 years old, he's a superstar. He's a celebrity. Anybody come across him? Zany, crazy books. Some people love them. Some adults hate them, but still, it doesn't matter. Kids love them. Zany, crazy books. His book readings are like a rock festival. I took my kids to them when they were about age. Just so screaming, you could feel the excitement. It's amazing. And he's a great orator, and he's very entertaining. His books are fun, and he writes. He obviously's got his market just right. So, let's look at The Paperback Princess. She's a kind of postmodern princess, doesn't need a prince. She's tough, she's good, that's all this dragon on her own. Thank you very much. Okay? So, here's The Paperback Princess. If you know all your Joel Phonics grapheme phoneme correspondences. Okay, this is if you know all of them and apply them. Okay. I can make you read them if you like, there won't be a test. You get the idea, right? If you have a go at reading that, the meaning does not leap off the page, does it? Okay. So maybe what we need to do to support children as they start engaging with real books is they need more grapheme phoneme correspondences. We need to teach the right ones. Okay. So I've added in a little bit here. Still not very easy if you just put in things like the. Doesn't help. You just teach a few sight words. That's what Ted Truman said. So you've got to look at what's there. You've got KN, NG, double B. These things are there, aren't they? You've got ED, weighted, shouted, tomorrow, today. You've got these complex patterns. Those are coming up all the time. Whole, as in whole world. So, one idea that I was influenced by, John Fasolity's work and Janet Fausten's work, on what they call the simplicity principle. And this is the idea that there is an optimal content to teach in any task, whether it's reading or not. There's an optimal content, it's kind of an instructional psychology idea, that will lead to maximal generalisation. It's painful to teach graphic phoneme correspondences, we need to be careful about which ones we teach. Are we teaching the most useful ones for the task? So what's optimal? Well, one way of looking at this is kind of to do some statistics. So they analysed 685 children's books, and they kind of tipped all the words out into a big file, and then analysed them to see what patterns predicted the readability of those texts. Okay. So, you find out some important things. First of all, high-frequency words are very high-frequency. The 100 most frequent English words accounted for 50% of the whole total. Now, 100 words, you know half of your texts. 64 of the most frequently occurring grapheme phoneme correspondences out of a total of 461 that you could, in principle, teach would enable children to read 60% of all word types. So their argument was, teach the right sight words, teach those 60 to 70 grapheme phoneme correspondences together, you're a long way to reading any text. We can get that laid down. Interestingly, they also show, if you plot the number of grapheme phoneme correspondences against the percentage of text that you can read across all those texts, look at the graph. You come up here, if you learn 30 grapheme phonemes, look how little text you can read. We've already shown that in the Paperback Princess. As you come up, it started to come up and you can read 50-60% of text. But you'll also see that it plateaus off. It's not worth, they would say, teaching grapheme phoneme number 75, 85, 95, 105, because you get diminishing returns. You just have to work it out, essentially. But that's their argument. See, there's a set of about 60 or 70 that are particularly useful, Janet Galston said. And here are some examples of the grapheme phoneme that they think are particularly important. So I've kept all the the regular ones that are in the phonics game, the first 30. These are from sort of 31 to 60. So we came back in year two, and we taught those to kids. Okay, that was our idea. We also checked to make sure, see if there's any difference between the UK ones and the Canadian ones. So we obtained loads of books from the Toronto Public Library System, which turns out to be the biggest public library system on the planet. And so we looked at all the books for children that were taken out, what's popular. We did the same analysis, Jonathan Solty helped us with these, and we identified the maximally useful units. Generally speaking, there's some comparisons, but the word bear is more common in Canadian children's books than in UK books. That's good, isn't it? That's useful. So, small study, we randomly allocated a small group of students, one of my master's students did this work, and we taught the intervention controls. Both sets of children were taught, these year twos, but in our intervention program, the complex graphing funny correspondences were taught, they learned with letter sound correspondences, and then did the appropriate shared book reading to go with it. And in the control program, they were taught spelling of the day without learning the graphing funny correspondence. They were exposed to the letters. They were exposed to the same letters, but they didn't get the pronunciation in that intervention. So they were building the word. They were sharing the word and identifying it in a story. So I think it was A, they might look at away and today, the shared book reading contexts. And they would, it would be cumulative. So each week they would add to the graphing volumes that they knew, and over time, a successful learner would be able to read the page, of course, because you've accumulated all those appropriate graphing volume correspondences to read real works. So I'll summarise our results there. Basically, what this means in English, these D's, these are effect sizes. That's how much change there was from the pretest to the post-test compared to the control condition. So researchers like this because they give an index of how big the effects were. And just to give you a sense, very often an effect size of 0.8 to 0.9 or above is considered a big effect size. Mm-hmm. So these are big, these are robust effect sizes. We're picking up significant change. If you're a teacher, you'd see it. And our teachers in this one did see it. Interestingly, we measured reading motivation in this study, and there was a growth in reading motivation as a result of reading intervention as well. And the motivation task that we used was Bill Tumler's one from New Zealand, and it differentiates different bits of motivation. And the thing that our students said were, reading seems easier now. They didn't improve across the board in motivation, but they did improve in that part that was about their perceptions of the difficulty of the task. So we helped them with that part, which is great. So, bigger study, essentially what we did is we replicated that. We just wanted to make that really big. And in science, one of the problems is that studies are out there, but they don't get replicated. We fail to find effects if someone looks at it a second or a third time, so it's important to replicate. So all of this to say, we ran it in 50 classrooms this time, much bigger. And in our replication study, we did find a pattern that was kind of similar. We find an interaction. So for all of these outcome measures, word reading, pseudo words, sentence reading, spelling, the simplicity intervention worked, but there was a caveat. The simplicity intervention worked for those children who had higher phonics skills. So if they had stronger phonics skills, the letter sound correspondences would stick and they could use them. But if they had lower phonological awareness, it wasn't as effective. So that's a strong cue. We didn't teach phonological awareness in this particular study. So the natural follow-up to that then is to look at what happens if you teach those graphing phoneme correspondences and important phonological skills like isolating sounds and blending and reflection. So that's still to be done. It's a clue that that works. So most of these children made improvements. Neither of these studies are a magic bullet. I've not come here to tell you I've got all the answers. We certainly added value. We're confident we got that. But they still struggle with many things. It helped at the word level, but it didn't solve the comprehension difficulties that a lot of these students had. We need other things there, and a balanced approach is going to do that. Even for some, the word level, particularly those who have poor phonological skills, the subset, they didn't catch up. So we've got to do something else there. But we've got a sense of some value added. Oops, excuse me, I'll just skip to slide. Last study, to tell you about a second. Turning to grade 3, year 3 readers. And here you could argue that struggling readers start to have really unique needs. You often get a distinct set of students arriving at the resource room or special needs coordinator's door who haven't been there before. Because by this point, children are dealing with more and more complex information, more and more complex texts, and the pressure on their comprehension and their vocabulary starts to really show. And where it might have been hidden early on in their careers, it starts to come in. This is the idea of late emerging reading difficulties, or later emerging reading difficulties. So what are we going to do for these kids? Very often, by the time they got to year 3, they've had lots of phonics, right? Okay, if it works, it works. But if it isn't working for them, what do we do? Do we keep banging the drum? What's the approach? This is a question. Some people have said, okay, maybe we need to do some other things. We need to support their wider language needs, so simplicity perhaps might have a role, but maybe we could do other things. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about something called structured word inquiry. Structured word inquiry starts with the assumption that English is morphophonemic, i.e., it's kind of a redescription of what I said earlier, that it's a deep or opaque system. But actually, part of that deepness or complexity comes from the fact that it codes for meanings as well as for sounds simultaneously. Okay. So, this is not a new idea. Richard Vanetsky, linguist, said, the simple fact is the present morphography is not merely a letter sound system riddled with imperfections, but instead a more complex and more regular relationship wherein phoneme and morpheme share leading roles. So it's not about teaching phonics and having a set of naughty words that don't follow the rules. They're saying there are two aspects to this phonic system. We need to teach both of them. So, the phoneme and the morpheme share leading roles. What's a morpheme? Well, I've come across the term. A morpheme is a bit like a phoneme. It's the smallest unit. But a morpheme is the smallest unit of meaning in a language, whereas a phoneme is the smallest unit of sound in a language. Okay. So, if you think about English, English is riddled with these morphemic connections. We've got words like bomb and bombardment. We've got nation and national. We've got sign. We've got signal. And what that signals, if you like, across all of these, is a shift in pronunciation. It doesn't respect pronunciation, but spelling is respected, and the links to meanings, shared meanings across words, is also respected. So, what we should do is teach the links between shared meanings in words and spellings. And we're going to have to navigate the problems around pronunciations, but not lead on that. So, the idea that Pete Bowers and colleagues have developed is focusing on, graphemic phonic correspondence is still there, within a frame of morphology and etymology. We need to know where these words came from. Who are their relatives? We need to know their families and their history. Okay. So a morpheme is the smallest unit of meaning. We have roots. These are words that can stand alone, like happy. And we have bound morphemes, which are essentially prefix and suffix units, like unhappy or unhappiness, etc. Etymology is the study of the history of words. And of the connectedness of words. So we can have words like react, which obviously children will say reeked to if they're applying the phonic rules. Morphology clarifies the phonology. The morphological structure is re plus act. Okay, there's a root and a bound morpheme. This rules out E as a digraph. because darkness references every possible field of boundaries. It explains all the word action includes a T rather than an SH, because it's about acting. And it helps unpick the spelling system. And it's also kind of interesting if you get into this. So the core of Pete Bowers' work is this idea of matrices. Looked at this one earlier? Okay, I'll fast forward. You know all about matrices? The idea is systematic, logical, clear. You've got the bound, you've got the root there, and then you've got that you can build around them. The interesting thing when you use them is how many words you can actually construct with some of these. Like dozens and dozens and dozens of words around a single thought. And that's a revelation to us as adults, let alone to children. So it's pretty interesting. And you get to be in charge of your own language. You get to really understand where these words are from, what this is all about. And it might even help your own spelling. So you can contrast what phonics might do compared to structured word environment. So for example, an ED, bound morpheme, could be played out as a set of individual phonic rules, or you can teach principles around the morphological relationships that are played out in each of these cases. We have a piece of work we're going to present this summer, that's been submitted, going to be submitted to a journal, it's not published, it hasn't been through peer review. It's a small study, but I thought you'd find this interesting, I wanted to add this on for you. We've got 48 English-speaking children living in Alberta. My colleague George was running this. We had a third of them in the simplistic principle, which you know all about. A third of them in structural body inquiry, which you also know all about. And we had no intervention controls like our baseline. We had an intervention pattern, which will probably recognise. We had about 10 weeks, three times a week, 20 to 25 minutes or so, something like that, 30 minutes. We had our trained psychology graduate students running this in classrooms. It was a randomised trial. We had a pre-test. No difference as a pre-test, or very few. Post-test and a delayed post-test to pick up the longer-term impacts. Okay, and that's kind of what I do. So we've got functional awareness, morphological awareness, children's sensitivity to these units. We've got different kinds of reading, children's sensitivity to the morphological relatedness between words. Can they tell you about patterns? And spelling. They're all well matched. We've matched them on attainment, and gender, and home language, parent report of development, history, and age. So we're not going to run tiny experiments. So, what do we get? This is that rat word reading measure that you've seen already for the year ones. This is the year threes. And what you can see is, if you look at the post-test, which is kind of a red-ish, I'm saying it's red, it's something like that. You can see advantages for the structured word inquiry and the simplicity over the control, but those advantages are bigger for the structured word inquiry. And most noticeably at all, the orange graph, when we go back after the summer break, we're actually seeing a slight increase, which is interesting, isn't it? But it's there for the structured word inquiry. Okay. And it's fallen back a little bit for the simplicity of the controls that push for. But that contrast between the structured word inquiry and the controls is again significant some months after we've run our 10 weeks of intervention. We found similar effects on this morphological reading task as well as on our isolated word reading, but we didn't find any other main effects on a number of other outcome measures. So I'm going to be scrupulously fair and honest about this. We found it in some measures but not others, but we did find it occasionally. But across those other measures, we did find something interesting, which was we found an interaction effect. What that means is that for the group who had the structured word inquiry, if they started with better morphological skills, they were more likely to show advantages in the intervention. Whereas if they had weaker morphological skills, they were less likely to show advantages. Sound familiar? Right? Got study two. So we're starting to see evidence about interactions here rather than just looking at blocked main effect. It's about horses for courses, it's a bit more individualized. So if we're looking at the patterns of the other people in front of us, maybe we're starting to get a clue about where we need to go with some of this. I'm going to put lots of cautions in on this, it's a small sample. It's not yet been peer reviewed. Somebody with a close inspector's eye might not like parts of what we do, we don't know yet. But it does fit a pact that's coming up in other teams. We're not the only people to have started looking at this morphological interventions. Others have found interventions as well, based upon the level of ability. So, if I were to summarise, I've presented three intervention studies in the Canadian equivalent of year one, year two, year three, with at-risk samples. And we have effects across all those studies. We were able to do something. The components seem to be about learning graphene-phoneme correspondences, picking the right ones, giving to the children a strategy for making sense of the deep spelling system in the early years. And as we move on, in later years, there's some evidence that teaching children about the morphological patterns that are present in the English language holds promise for supporting them. So those are my take-home messages around these here. All with a due sense of caution, but I think we've got something here, and at least some of it's been replicated, and we're about to replicate the year one study at scale, I think, here in the UK. So we'll know in a very large number of schools if that plays out. But certainly, I would suggest things to be excited about at this stage. I hope you found it interesting. Very happy to answer all questions.